Yes, we need a tissue culture step, but it's a bit simpler. So there are fewer barriers to crossing, interploidy crossing, when it's tetraploid, hexaploid, than if it's diploid, hexaploid. If that answers.
And so in the elite material, there must be very little
D-diversity. Yes, there is. And in almost any linkage map you see published of hexaploid wheat, there will be there tends to be a shorter map length on the D genome than the A and B, and fewer polymorphic loci. And Sod's law says that if you're trying to clone a gene and it's the D genome homolog you're after, you won't be able to get markers very close to it, because the variation just isn't there. It's all identical by descent. Mm. Short answer is no, I haven't. I have heard of a company in Israel who make octoploid wheat, and it has no D genome. So they take the tetraploid durum wheat and they double that again. So instead of being AABB, it's AAAABBBB. And they claim they have some outrageous claims, which I'd love to find out more about, but it's the IP is quite tightly controlled at the moment. They've not published on it. It's sort of commercial know-how. So yeah, I'm itching to get my hand on that sort of thing. A thought experiment I'd like to do is to go diploid, tetraploid, hexaploid, and then if you go octoploid, then it might be a triticale. So this time you have the A and B and D genomes that the hexaploid wheat has, but you bring in the rye genome as well. So there is a crop called octoploid triticale, and I've always wanted to do those sequential hybridization steps and see, you know, what happens, but I've never got around to doing it. It's a quirk that plants have, is that they frequently have polyploidy, autopolyploidy, where it's the same genome duplicated twice, or allopolyploidy, where it's different genomes brought together. And it seems to have happened so many times independently across the plant kingdom, and being retained, that it clearly is bringing some selective advantage. So the point I made right at the start about using mutants in barley but not in wheat, because if you knock something out, you'll see it in barley, but in wheat you've got two other copies to buffer it. Well, that's probably quite a good thing in evolutionary terms. So a mutation won't necessarily be lethal. You can tolerate a lot more environmental stress if you're polyploid. So in some ways it's a good thing. And it seems to be peculiar to plants rather than animals. There aren't many polyploid animals compared to plants. Right, I better hand over to Leslie, I think.
Just when Mel and Sarah's question, we're in quarter past. Okay, so I have one more. Well, it's just coming, and we'll tell them over there. Because I don't want to hold up my colleagues.
First question. Hands up, who knows what race specific resistance? I want to know what pitch I need to accept. Race-specific resistance in disease pathology? No? Nobody?
So a lot of the disease material will be next term. So
okay.
Next term's
but
all
I mean, just maybe at A-level they did. Yeah. So you've never talked about our genes and avirulence factors in the pathogen? No? Nobody knows about that? Right, okay. I'll keep it simple. Right, you see what I'm doing?
Thank you.
So, my name's Lizzie Boy. I suppose you could call me a wee pathologist. I've worked with, for a long time, on rust diseases of wheat. So rusts are a fungal pathogen. And what I want to talk about today is some of my work, but also how my work fits into a global context. Because I think you saw from Phil's talk that work on crops, you can't do it alone. It's about partnership, it's about collaboration. And I do a lot of work with Africa and the developing world, and there you have to work as a team, as a global team. So first of all, I'll introduce you to the beast, or the beasts. So there are a group of fungal pathogens, which we refer to as the rusts. They're puccinias, they're biotrophs. They need a living organism to grow and reproduce. So they have to keep the plant alive. We have brown rust, also known as leaf rust, depending on where you are in the world. We have black rust, known as stem rust. And we have yellow rust, also known as stripe rust. They each prefer slightly different climatic conditions. Yellow rust is the disease, the rust that we most prevalently have in the UK. It's like cooler, more maritime conditions, or it will can be found at higher elevations. Black rust is the hot beast, likes it warm, higher temperatures, which you actually infect the plant. And then brown rust is somewhere in the middle. Okay? But because of the different climatic options or preferences that these three fungal pathogens have, basically you can find the rusts wherever you find them. Okay? And this is just a very schematic to give you an idea of where wheat's growing, you find rusts. Now, here in Northern Europe, as I said, yellow rust, slightly more maritime, cooler conditions. But you can get yellow rust in Africa, because in Africa, in East Africa, they grow wheat at higher elevations. They grow on the slopes of Kenya, and such like conditions. And yet you come down into Brazil, leaf rust tends to predominate because it's slightly warm. Okay? But the thing is, with all current knowledge we have of rusts, and our constant battle to defeat the disease by breeding for resistance, by using fungicides to control the disease, this pathogen is spreading. It's being found in new parts of the world where wheat's grown. And it's probably for two reasons. One, because of climatic changes, and I'll give you some examples. Where the climate is fluctuating, rust is found where, or particular rusts are found where they weren't previously found. But also because the pathogen's changing. You have to remember that like any living organism, it wants to survive. It evolves, it mutates. It's under selection pressure, it changes. And that's where we have this constant battle between us, the humans and the plant breeders, who are trying to breed new resistance into the crop and the pathogen. So every resistance gene we stick into the plant, okay, the pathogen changes, it mutates. It changes its arsenal of proteins that it uses to infect the plant. Okay? So when the plant says, I recognize that pathogen, what does the pathogen do? It changes the protein that the plant recognizes, the resistant gene recognizes. And in changing that protein, the plant no longer sees it. And that's the gene-to-gene hypothesis. One gene in the plant recognizes one gene in the pathogen. But the pathogen says, I'm not having this. It's going to get better than me. I'll throw that protein out. I've got another one. I don't need it. And the resistance is no longer affected. So, where do we find new rusts? Some examples. And where shall I start? Okay, so in 2000, yellow rust, often found on the west coast of the United States, but then in 2000 it suddenly reappeared in the central plains of America. And if you know your geography, continental plains, the central plains of the world, okay? Didn't normally see yellow rust on the central coast. Why? Because this new race was more aggressive. It changed. It had grown in higher temperatures to survive in higher temperatures. Experiments have been shown that in fact it is more aggressive and more capable of producing spore
under harsher conditions.
2 years later, that same race, or that same lineage, appeared here in Western Australia. Now in Australia, in the east, yellow rust has been around since 74, but it never got to the west because it was warmer there. But this new isolate, this new lineage, from the central plains of America, we're not sure how it got there. Probably it turned up to somebody's trousers. Probably on holiday in the States, visited a farm, didn't take the necessary precautions, and we know the spores can survive a long time, carried it all the way back to Australia. So we now find the disease parts of the wheat growing belt where it wasn't seen before. Similarly, in South Africa, yellow rust, never a problem. Leaf rust, black rust, but we found in 96 yellow rust appeared. And this was probably because in that year the summer was cooler, or I should say the summer, the winter, because it got over winter, was cooler and the disease took effect. So both mutation within the pathogen, changes in the climate, are causing these diseases to spread and be found where they weren't found before. In 2013, in Central Europe and Germany, where we haven't seen black rust as a disease in probably 60, 70 years, they found black rust. Okay, they found it on untreated trials, it hadn't been treated fungicide, but warm summer, warmer condition, climate change, black rust. Now the European wheat breeder hasn't selected and bred for resistance to black rust in over 50 years. So are we going to see the disease reappear here? We know that most of our varieties wouldn't stand up to it. But the big problem occurred in Uganda in 1998. Stem rust in spring wheat that had grown in a developing world hadn't been seen in over 30 or 40 years because of the use of one single resistance gene that came in from rye. Remained effective all that time. But in this year, that resistance broke. The pathogen mutated and it overcame that resistance. And we had what is globally known as the UG99 race. And this race alone took out 70% of all the spring wheat varieties that were grown by developing countries. Africa, India, the Middle East, devastated. Gene overcome was SL31. So this one act alone, we took out so many wheat varieties in parts of the world where their agriculture system is almost teeters on the edge between growing enough and starvation, that it's brought the international community together. This is just a just one step back. So the disease appeared here in Eastern Africa, but the big theory is where's this new UG99 race going to go? Where are we going to see it next? And we know from prevailing wind patterns, prevailing wind movements, how the rust pathogen can spread, because it's light, it's generally spread on the air, it can be carried on clothing, carried on animals, birds, and it's spreading. We see it now in South Africa, we see it in Yemen, Iran. And the next fear is it going to move into the Punjab, the big wheat growing area for India. So the international community got together and said we need to do something about this. And we formed the Global Rust Initiative to work together, funded very nicely by lots of money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, through our own Department for International Development, also projects that I have with BESRC. And we named the initiative the Borlaug Global Rust Initiative, as Phil mentioned. Borlaug was the first director of CIMIC, which is an international wheat breeding station in Mexico, initially funded by the Rockefeller. A great man, a great pioneer, even at the age of 90, he would be off talking to people, we've got to solve this problem, we need money, put money in. Fortunately, he's passed away now. So what do we do? What is it we want to know? Okay, we want to find new sources of resistance to this new UG99. But we also want to make sure that we can follow this pathogen. We want global surveillance systems. So in the direct world, we have surveillance systems. Here at NIAC, farmers send us isolates of yellow rust, leaf rust every year. We look at them to say, right, what wheat varieties do these isolates grow on? Have we found a new isolate that can now grow on a wheat variety that it was before resistant? And if we find that, we know we have a new virulence. We know that the pathogen is mutated, and we now have a new virulence, and it can grow on a variety which used to be resistant. Obviously now, it's no longer resistant. We need to know that. We need to know that every year. We need to know how the pathogen population is changing. But we need to know it globally, because as we see, an isolate that appears on the Great Plains of America in 2000 appears in Australia 2 years later. So we have to monitor them, we have to follow them. But we also have to educate. We have to support and educate and train people in parts of the world that are not as fortunate as we are to have access to facilities and know-how. And we must stop. I'll just skip. This is just the story in Europe. We need to be able to support these people and work together as a community to fight these pathogens. And like I say, we have programs here where we work in South Africa and Kenya and India. And through the global community, through teamwork, and this is just my collaborators who work on rusts, black rust, yellow rust primarily. I might add a few more Brazilians to that picture because we might have a project on leaf rust. But it's all about teamwork. And we're all experts in different things. You know, we have expert pathologists, we have experts in molecular biology, in markers, we have experts from CIMIC who are marker experts, we have bioinformaticians, we have people who work on the pathogen, on the genome of the pathogen, looking for those changed proteins, those effectors, those virulence factors. There's me in Kenya, doing a field trial, take necessary quarantine portions. I didn't want to bring back black rust spores from Kenya into the UK, so I wore my boiler suit. So it's about partnership. It's about working with people around the world, bringing people together to form networks, to stop the marginalisation of knowledge and technologies, that we share what we have with everybody. To make sure there's an effective pipeline for delivery of that new knowledge and new technologies that we develop. It's about forming, training people, students, staff, forming collaborations, working together. Also within our projects, obviously, we're doing science. We're identifying new sources of resistance. And within my own projects, we've identified sources of yellow rust in South African cultivars, in European cultivars. Sources, genes that we've located on the chromosomes. We've developed markers to identify those genes. Again, I'm not sure how much you know, but you can develop a piece of DNA that you can actually physically identify within your plants that you know is linked to your gene. Okay? So you have a physical marker to follow that gene. When you cross your plants, you can follow the gene for a year. And in South Africa, these genes are being used by the breeders. We know it's a very small community, and that material is already being used. But to ensure that they can also use those DNA markers, those physical tags, we must ensure that the people have access to the technology. So within our current project, we introduced into the lab here in South Africa, and yes, it's all women, it's another story. But we did a deal with LCG Genomics to buy the equipment to establish a technology, a marker DNA technology called CASPR, which identifies single nucleotide polymorphisms within bits of DNA, within genes, which are linked to your rust resistance genes. And you can use that physical marker to follow the gene. And that's the technology that the UK breeders use. We thought it was good enough for them, we'll put it in South Africa. In Kenya, we introduced a simpler technology, but we bought basic lab equipment, which all of us take for granted. We introduced it into Kenya, and they can now use simple SSR markers as part of their wheat breeding. So again, it's training, knowledge, expertise, pass that on to, okay, we had a workshop, Ian here from NIA, gave us a nice workshop on genome selection, breeding technology, breeding methodology. We've trained PhD students. It's about ensuring that that knowledge and expertise is passed on. And that beyond the programme, even though you may not have the funding for the project anymore, the links have been established, the ties have been established, and the knowledge exchange continues. So coming on from that, you're probably not aware, but a few years ago, NIA set up a new initiative, NIAB International, to see how, beyond my own research, but how NIAB more generally can interact with developing countries to support agriculture in the way it supports UK agriculture. You know, through knowledge dissemination, through technologies, through training, and leading on from the projects that we've had. We now have a 2-year project to help us do just that. Because two of the bottlenecks in a lot of African countries, a lot of money has been put into breeding new crops. So within the countries, in country, they breed new crops, and it's not just for wheat, it's for cassava, it's for rice, it's for sweet potato, it's for some spinach vegetable, beans. They have all these new varieties. But a lot of them are not being used by the smallholder farmers, with a whole host of reasons. So we're working with this project, building out on our previous collaborations. So the Kenyans have bred all these fantastic new wheat varieties. Why are the smallholder farmers not using them? So we're working with the smallholder farmer communities, engaging with them, supporting them in growing these varieties so they can see firsthand how better and how they perform on their land, how best to grow them, what's the best agronomic inputs, and also to take the information that we've gleaned from that experience and pass it on through dissemination to other farmers, other farming communities within the area. And it's become quite obvious that the way to do that is mobile phones. Because, you know, they may not have electric lights, they may not have a microwave, they might not have shoes on their children's feet as they walk to school, but they have a mobile phone. And they go to the local store, which has a solar panel, and they plug it in every week and they charge up their mobile phone. So we use what is there. And we're developing apps that tell them, a small program to say, this is how you sow your seed. This is what you need to put onto your seed. So we're using the platforms that are there in Africa to help disseminate the knowledge and experience that we have here and that we're gleaning from working within the African context. Again, partnerships, teams, we're working with Tanashi, who runs or manages NIAB International, the people in Kenya, and a charitable trust here in Cambridge, who are experts on dissemination. So the message there is no one person can do it on their own. It's about teamwork. Well, I think basically, that's all I need to say. I don't want to hold my transformation team up. So think about it. I don't want any questions, but you've got to move on. But if you do have any questions, I'll walk back with you, Mark, in a minute. Okay?